Indicted Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fatah's trial got underway today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Back from the federal courthouse in Philadelphia, and joining me with the latest is WHYY's Aaron Mozell. Good evening, Aaron.
Good evening, Dave.
Before we get to today's proceedings, take us back to what got us to this day.
Sure. So today's court date comes nearly a year after federal prosecutors first announced charges against Congressman Fatah and four associates, who the government referred to as Fatah's loyal subordinates. Those associates, real quickly, are Herbert Viderman, a former deputy mayor of Philadelphia, Bonnie Bowser, she's a former chief of staff in Fatah's congressional office in Philadelphia, Karen Nicholas, a former Fatah staffer who ran an education nonprofit Fatah founded, and lastly, Bob Brand, who founded a for-profit entity that Fatah has ties to. And the government maintains that Fatah orchestrated a series of schemes with this group that together they worked as this criminal enterprise in the name of political and personal gain. Fatah is charged with racketeering. He's also charged with bribery, wire fraud, bank fraud, and a whole host of other offenses. We're talking about 24 counts in all. More specifically, he's accused of misusing hundreds of thousands of dollars in charitable donations, grant money, and campaign contributions. That last piece, the campaign contributions, sits at the center of this case. The government alleges that Fatah took an illegal $1 million loan to his failed run for mayor, Philadelphia mayor, in 2007. This is the year that Mayor Nutter was ultimately elected. The accusations are that Fatah allegedly used the nonprofit led by Nicholas, Karen Nicholas, and the for-profit run by Brand, Bob Brand, to repay part of that $1 million loan.
So in the context of these extensive charges, did Fatah take the opportunity to interface with the press at all this morning?
So Fatah got to the courthouse, you know, a bit before 9 a.m., and he kind of just seemed like his regular self, which is to say, you know, pretty upbeat, pretty peppy. There's that trademark smile that you'll often see crawl across Fatah's mouth. And he did interface with the reporters for a little bit, sort of mostly thanking his legal team and his voters. And here's what he had to say.
I want to say thank you to the voters and the citizens who supported me and for their prayers over these many, many years. Thank you very much.
So these comments aren't that surprising, actually, given that Fatah's attitude towards this entire case is that he's innocent and that he's repeatedly called these charges against him frivolous.
So what happened with his legal team?
So today is mostly taken up by opening arguments, as most court cases are the first day. And it started off with the government taking time, followed by Fatah's lawyer and then his four co-defendants. The government spent most of its time detailing the alleged schemes that were laid out in the indictment, making sure to point out that Fatah was both aware of and had his fingerprints on all of this, whether it was the illegal campaign loan that we talked about, whether it was him sending campaign cash to pay off his son's college debt or accepting a bribe from a close friend. And in response, Fatah's lawyer said that Fatah simply had nothing to do with it, that he was removed from a lot of these activities. When it comes to that illegal campaign loan that we talked about, Fatah's attorney said that as far as Fatah knew, all of the money coming into the campaign was lawful. Who knew otherwise, he said, was a pair of political consultants who have pleaded guilty and, as he sees it, are essentially eager to get a good deal from the government.
Is there a general sense of how long it will take to present this complex case to jurors and when it gets into their hands?
Sure. So this is the first day of what's expected to be a weeks-long case. I think both sides have it said it could be up to 2 months. Moving forward, we're expected to hear from those two political consultants that I mentioned. And whether we hear from Fatah himself, that's unclear. But given, as we said, the length of the case, his attorneys will have a lot of time to make that decision. I should point out that no matter what happens here, Fatah is not going to be returning to Congress because last month he lost the Democratic primary. This is after more than two decades in office.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
WHYY's Aaron Mozell on NewsWorks Tonight. What would it cost to ensure that every student in Pennsylvania meet academic standards? As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, one advocacy organization says state data point to the need for at least $3.2 billion in added state funding.
When a bipartisan state commission published its report last year, it came up with a new formula for distributing new state education dollars. The formula acknowledges that districts face added burdens, for instance, when educating students in poverty or still learning English. But the panel very specifically avoided a crucial question. How much money would it take for all students to score proficient on state tests?
Nobody has been actually talking about what districts really need.
So Public Interest Law Center attorney Michael Churchill did his own analysis. If the new formula is applied to the average instructional costs of schools statewide, he concluded that on the conservative side, schools need $16.5 billion in added support, $3.2 billion of which he says should come from the state. To reach this figure, the Law Center advocates for a $400 million increase in each of the next 8 years. After a historic budget impasse that ultimately saw a $200 million education boost, does Governor Wolf think that's politically possible?
No.
To which Churchill says,
it's been politically impossible in the past because no one has been willing to say this is what the General Assembly's own studies show is needed.
Republican leaders say they're not convinced public schools will improve with more state funding. Wolf is pushing for a $350 million education boost in this year's budget, but is noncommittal beyond that. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Philadelphia is taking a more targeted approach to homeless outreach. Workers are now focusing on specific areas and helping homeless people with individualized services. Mike and Scott reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
Complaints about homeless people in Center City have been increasing lately, and some of them concern new gathering spots, says David Holloman. He directs community outreach for the Office of Supported Housing.
So what we did was looked at some of our maps, some of our data that we currently collect, and see where more people are starting to pop up, and also say, hey, outreach is out here. They're out here every day of the week.
Outreach workers now wear bright orange uniform shirts to be more visible.
You might be in a different space, different day.
Outreach worker Tom Felder is talking to a young man sitting on Arch Street near the Philadelphia Convention Center, one of the new hotspot areas. The man holds a sign that reads, "Veteran, please help."
So far, he hasn't expressed a willingness to accept any of the services that we offer, but through consistency, we're going to hope that eventually he will.
Felder's team is focusing on the area around the convention center. He says it often takes many attempts before a person is ready to accept help. Many of the homeless people have mental health and substance use issues, and outreach workers are trained to recognize these problems and to refer them to special services, says Arthur Evans. He heads the city's Department of Behavioral Health.
For example, we have programs called Safe Havens. Those are small, specialized shelters specifically designed for people who are experiencing mental illness or substance use.
Yes, I'm going to get you next time.
Back at the convention center, Tom Felder tries to connect with other homeless people, but he doesn't have any takers. He accepts that, but he's ready to return later on or tomorrow.
Okay, so y'all good? Anything we can do for you?
I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News. Okay.
Donald Trump was not the first choice of many Republicans in Congress from our region. Now that he's the party's apparent nominee, most are embracing him in their own way. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports on the debate in the GOP over the party's controversial standard bearer.
Want to hear a pretty representative endorsement of Donald Trump from a Philadelphia area lawmaker?
What are the choices?
I know.
What are the choices?
Yeah. That's the calculus for why retiring Republican Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick from Bucks County supports Trump. He says from what he can tell, the real estate magnate will nominate a better replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia than any of the Democrats will.
Yeah, I'm going to support the candidate that puts reasonable conservatives on the Supreme Court. Supreme Court is 4-4 now, and so that's the most important issue to me.
House Speaker Paul Ryan has withheld his support from Trump thus far, while a few other prominent conservatives are refusing to ever vote for Trump. Lehigh Valley Republican Congressman Charlie Dent says Trump is worrisome and he can't toss his support behind him just yet, if ever.
Even those who support him have expressed concerns. How many times have I heard one of my colleagues who say they endorse Donald Trump say, but I disagree with what he says on XYZ? You know, that's a tough spot to be in.
Dent says many of Trump's policy positions scare him on one level, but then again, he never knows what he's getting.
He changes positions pretty regularly, from what I can tell. So... He's pretty, in that regard, he's pretty malleable.
Then there's Trump's tongue, which many Republicans wish they could tame. Leonard Lance from Central Jersey says he hasn't liked some of the inflammatory rhetoric he's heard from Trump, but he's not worried that backing Trump will make voters think that they are cut from the same cloth.
No one would confuse my personality with his or his personality with mine, and I hope moving forward he is respectful of the views of others.
Lance says the best thing about Trump is that he's greatly expanded the GOP tent and attracted disaffected voters who have sat out the last few election cycles or who never voted before.
I think he has brought many new voters into the process, and I think he will continue to do that.
And what about the GOP agenda? Trump criticizes NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and trade policy towards China, while most Republicans have backed those trade deals. Trump doesn't want to touch Medicare or Social Security, while many House Republicans have voted to turn Medicare into a voucher program. Even with the differences, South Jersey's Tom MacArthur says from foreign policy to the economy, Trump is much more closely aligned with his party than a Hillary Clinton administration would be.
And the things that we want to do here in Congress have a much better chance of going somewhere under a Republican president than under Hillary Clinton. And so he'll have my support.
The GOP convention in July is supposed to be a time to unify and celebrate the party. But this year, with Trump on top, many Republicans in tough re-election battles are planning to skip it. Just like Pennsylvania incumbent Senator Pat Toomey, MacArthur says he hasn't decided whether he'll attend.
My focus is on my own race, it's on my own district, and on the issues that matter most to South Jersey.
Pennsylvania Congressman Lou Barletta and Tom Marino endorsed Trump ahead of the state's primary. Marino, who represents a sprawling, mostly rural district in central and northern Pennsylvania, says he's not worried that Senator Toomey and others in the party are keeping Trump at arm's length.
He may come around, maybe he won't. He's a little different of a position. I'm in a very conservative district. He has the whole state to contend with. But I think eventually most of the Republicans will come around.
Democrats are now giving us a glimpse of their general election strategy by painting Republicans as being in lockstep with all of the inflammatory comments Trump has made on everything from women to Muslims. But Marino doesn't think that line of attack will work.
The establishment, they're very afraid of Donald Trump, but they're terrified of the American people who are voting for him. And he has the largest number of votes in a primary in the history of this country and the Republican Party. So people say he should change this, he should change that. Back in Pennsylvania, we say if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
But many Republicans think Trump's tone is broken. That internal party debate over how they want to be portrayed seems like it will continue brewing until at least the convention in July. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Still ahead this evening, the 76ers will start wearing their brand allegiance on their sleeves. Literally. But exactly how sacrilegious is it to put advertising on basketball jerseys?
Football fields and soccer fields and baseball fields, they're all surrounded with advertising. So this is just the last bastion.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Owners of the Philadelphia 76ers are defending their decision to be the first NBA team to put a corporate sponsor on players' jerseys. A small logo from the ticket resale site StubHub will appear on the front left of players' jerseys, and some fans think that's bad form. WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
Many Sixers fans have an emotional connection to their team's blue and white basketball jersey and think advertisements will taint it.
The fans really see this as the purest symbol of the team.
Daniel Korshin, who teaches marketing at Drexel, says when you mix teams and brands, there's going to be some resistance.
Let's say that you love Pepsi and you love the Sixers, and then Coke becomes the sponsor of the Sixers. How do you react to that?
Some fans on Twitter compared the jersey to the American flag. It shouldn't be messed with. Another fan said the decision made them, quote, absolutely sick. But to the 76ers corporate development manager, Chad Biggs, it's good for everyone. Exposure for StubHub, which is owned by eBay. The company will pay the Sixers $5 million a year for the 2-inch by 2-inch patch.
You know, the Sixers being at the forefront of this is a positive thing. It obviously is a new revenue stream for us, and that will benefit not only the team, but also the fans.
Advertising on sports jerseys is popular in Europe, but it's taken this long for America's established teams to catch up. Drexel's Korshan says it was only a matter of time.
Football fields and soccer fields and baseball fields, they're all surrounded with advertising. So this is just the last bastion.
Though jerseys worn by players will now be blessed by StubHub, the ones available for purchase at stores won't bear the logo. Each of its past three seasons, the 76ers won fewer than 20 games. So StubHub isn't buying visibility with a hot team. Could this partnership sell more tickets and make the Sixers arena less empty? A team can hope. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Another batch of planets discovered orbiting distant suns. Let's get energized with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this isn't news, is it?
Oh, indeed it is news. You know, we've been talking about the fact that the Kepler spacecraft has been identifying candidate objects to be planets orbiting distant stars. Now, we know that the Kepler spacecraft has been looking at 150,000 stars at a distance of 3,000 light years.
All in our Milky Way?
All in our galaxy, yes, all in our galaxy. Relatively close. 3,000 light years is not that far away. And of those 150,000 that it has observed, the data collected on 4,000 suggests that there could be planets orbiting those stars. Now, of those 4,000, we have, up to a week ago, had identified 1,047 planets that indeed did show themselves, objects to show themselves to be planets. But a new report that has just recently been released indicates that there are at least 1,280 plus more planets confirmed.
That's a lot more. Now, this is just based on a closer look at existing data?
Yes, it actually is. And it's a very interesting look at this data. In fact, they determined that they had objects that satisfied 99% of those criteria that made those other objects planets. They feel pretty certain that what they are actually seeing are planets orbiting other stars.
Are we getting an overall sense that most stars likely have planets?
Well, this is the cool thing that we really have to realize about the statistical analysis, is that it is for real. This is not just, you know, dreamy or modelings. But the fact of the matter is that it now is generally accepted by the astronomical community as a whole that it is much more common for a star to have a planetary system than to not have a planetary system. 25 years ago, we knew of one star that had any kind of planets at all. That's this one. Now, it is generally assumed that as you look at stars in the night sky across this galaxy, more than likely, there's a planetary system there.
Though it does get dreamy when we speculate about planets that might exist in the so-called Goldilocks region.
Yes, that's true. That number of planets is much, much smaller. But the predominant type of planets found in that Goldilocks zone happen to be Earth-like or super-Earth-like. Now, Earth-like is a rather broad term that's being used. We're looking for objects that are about the size of this planet in the habitable zone, meaning that they are at the right distance from their sun to have the right temperature for water to exist as a liquid. That's a very important piece of this. But when we start to spread those parameters a little bit, even within the habitable zone, what we come up with is that we find that there are objects that are something like Earth, but much bigger. So, for example, out of this new batch, nine planets out of this 1,287 or so are identified as being in the habitable zone. But those nine have great variability. One of these, Kepler-1638b, happens to be 60% larger than Earth. The other one, Kepler-1229b, is about the size of Earth, but its star is much smaller and much cooler than ours.
Derek, we have a moment left. What's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
Oh, there's really great stuff coming up this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights at about 10 to 11 o'clock. Over on the eastern side of the sky, you can find four great objects easily visible. One of them, of course, is the moon. That'll be the brighter one. But you'll also find Saturn and Mars just above the eastern horizon. And on Saturday night, They form a box with a fourth object, a star called Antares. It's the brightest star in the constellation Scorpius the Scorpion, one of the summer constellations. And on Saturday night, the four together will make a box, and Antares will be the lowest corner of that box. You'll easily be able to identify the others because the moon will make the upper corner of the box, and the two planets Mars and Saturn will make the opposing corners of the box.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.